Fly me to the moon.
Showtime! The Linux Link Tech Show. The Linux Link Tech Show is on. Your link to the latest in GNU Linux and technology. An hour of insightful guests, tech info, and playful banter. Free software, free speech, open source, open mics. Live from the Linux Link Tech Show studio, here are your hosts, Dan, Alan, Pat, and Link. Link it up, and take it away. Take it away.
Hey, we're all here today.
Flesh!
Oh!
He saved every one of us!
And if you wonder why we're singing that, it's because you should have been listening earlier. That's why.
Yeah, so always tune in for the pre-game show.
Yeah. Oh, my phone's ringing, and I gotta keep talking, guys, because it's my daughter. She's in Disney right now.
Oh.
Where is she?
Daddy!
The drugs, ooh, they're cheaper down here. I can get a flu shot. So what's happening, Dan? What's going on this week? Anything?
Whole lot of crap.
So you got your...
Let's talk about the power... Let's finish this PowerBook saga. Because that was fun and exciting.
Did you finish it?
I did. You know why it wasn't booting? Guess why it wasn't booting up last week.
You took the plug out.
Wrong screw. Wrong size screw. Putting in the panel on the bottom. The wrong size screw was putting in the little cover that goes over top of the memory.
Talk into the mic, not across the mic.
The wrong size screw was going into the bottom panel that covers the memory. Because I took it all,
nice.
All apart, and I turned it on when I had it like all little pieces pulled apart. I turned it on; it was going on fine. I put it back together, and I turned it on, and it wouldn't go on. And then I take it apart, and I turn it on, and it goes on. I put it back together with just the keyboard in there, and then none of the other stuff in there, and it goes on. And then I put it all back together, and it doesn't go on again. And I'm like, what the hell? So I take the memory panel off, and I turn it on, and it goes on. So I'm like, oh, I must have the wrong size screw. I mean, what you're talking about, a millimeter and a half difference between the one screw and the other?
Listen,
just enough to touch out something in short.
It's a superior Apple product, and it knows the difference.
And to top it all off, once I finished that, and I was done with the encoding of the show last week, I wanted to drop it onto my iPod, and my iPod hard drive got corrupted, and it just blew up, and I lost everything on the damn iPod.
Life's a bitch, man.
It is. Life so I had to wipe it out. I had to reformat the iPod, and I started putting my stuff on it. The first message I got when I reformatted the iPod, it said, "All the music I purchased from iTunes cannot be played on this iPod because it's not registered to be used with that." I was like, what a
loser.
Piece of rotten garbage. And somebody had mentioned, why not try iPod Linux on it? And I did. I threw iPod Linux on there. Now, I did the wimpy install from the OS X installer because it was, about 1 o'clock in the morning when I started doing this.
I saw your post came in at like 4:45 in the morning.
Yeah.
I'm like, I looked at that the next morning going, God, I'm on my way to fucking work at that time.
Yeah, that was a long night. The first problem I had, iPod Linux, getting it on there with the iPod, because it is HFS Plus formatted on here, and iPod Linux will run right alongside the regular.
So what do you go with, the FireWire card?
Huh?
FireWire?
Yeah, it's a FireWire. And I put it on there through the OS X because it was just easy to do. The first problem I had with it was when it booted up into Linux, and I chose that as my default boot up option.
Unplug that, Dan, because you're grounding over here.
Yeah, there we go. When I chose that as my default boot option, the contrast was set all the way down. So all I had was a white screen. I couldn't see a damn thing. So I'm sitting there, like, trying to click through it and look at the screen sideways and figure out how I can get to the contrast settings. And I'm looking on their website, and the one thing has directions that say click down 4 and then over 1. And And you know, but that was wrong because the version changed. And I'm looking at the pictures on the website trying to figure out how to get to the settings menu. So eventually I got to it. It took me about 10 minutes and reading a bunch of posts. I got to it. I turned it up. I played, everything seemed to be working fine. I played a podcast that I copied on here and I thought it played fine. All right. So the next thing I thought to myself, well, if it's running Linux, it's got to be able to run an OGG file, play an OGG file. So I start doing some searching around for OGG files and stuff like that, play an OGG. And I found that there was an alpha version of Podzilla, which is the browser on the iPod Linux, which will play OGG files. So I pulled that down, connected it up to my system, copied it over, backed up my old Podzilla file and put the new one in there, and rebooted the damn thing, started it up, and played an OGG file. But the OGG file played back really like fast, like double speed and distorted.
Mm-hmm.
So I was like, oh, that sucks. So I dropped back down, connected it to my machine, copied, and went in, restored the original Podzilla, put it back up again, and played an MP3 file. And now the MP3 file was playing at like twice the speed, like you heard right there.
Yeah.
I'm like, what the hell's going on? So I'm thinking, well, maybe, you know, for some reason something got corrupted. So I wiped out iPod Linux. I reinstalled it. Then I had to go through the contrast thing again and sitting there trying to count the clicks and you, with the sensitivity. And it was just such a nightmare. So I got it back on there, and I played an MP3 file again, a podcast, and it was still double speed and distorted. And I'm like, what is going on? This doesn't make sense. I could have sworn it played fine before. So I tried one more time. I wiped out the iPod Linux. I restored it. Then I updated it from the client. And they moved the settings, the contrast settings. So it took me another 15 minutes to find the settings and get to the contrast because they moved it. And it still was not playing MP3s properly. So but you saw tonight, when I copied over an actual song with a higher bit rate, I guess 128 or something,
probably
it plays fine. So it's kind of like the OGG, the problem that the OGG has, the iRiver has with OGGs or something. It's not accepting certain bit rates through the iPod Linux, which bums me out. But to top it all off, I keep having this problem, which I thought it was my workstation and the maybe something with the newest kernels. But when I plug the damn thing in on my Linux box, because I'm sick of using the Apple, screw the Apple, screw iTunes, I'm just using GTK Pod, because all I'm doing is copying over podcasts now. I don't have any music on this thing.
Mm-hmm.
I plug the damn thing in. It tells me it can't sync the hard drive on here through the FireWire. So I can't connect it through the FireWire. So like I got to pull it out, plug it back in, pull it out, plug it back in, reset it, pull it out, plug it back in, take it to another system. I take it over here to my my PPC, plug it in, and I'm like, oh, it works, right? So it must be that something to do with that kernel there. So I'm using it. I go in to plug it in today to copy over that song to try it out. Damn thing doesn't work again. It worked for a little bit, but when I pulled it out, plugged it back in, it wouldn't work again.
It wouldn't work again.
I couldn't connect. It kept telling me there was a problem, an I.O. problem. So I rebooted my machine into OS X, connected it up in there, no problem. Then I rebooted back into Linux, and I connect it up again. So it's like I have to reboot. I have to connect it into iTunes to reset whatever needs to be reset on the damn
fucking
thing,
Apple,
so I can copy it over. And it's just, oh, it's. And I had it on the charger yesterday, and I went to the lug meeting last night, and I listened to some podcasts, some Twat, and some Bin Rev, and I listened to. By the time I got done with the lug meeting, I got most of the way home, the damn thing died. Power was gone. I got like, what, 3 or 4 hours out of the damn thing, if that? Oh.
Excellent product.
Yeah.
Time to buy a battery.
Time to throw it out the damn window.
Speaking of new products.
Time to get yourself a new iRiver, man.
I've got my $555.
I'm
going to
get that
laptop.
GPX too. It's not released yet for sale, but another thing, speaking of all that stuff that I want to bring up, last week we had, and the week before that, we had mentioned about Neverwinter Nights 2 and going to the forum, Atari's forum, to request a Linux client. Well, if you've been watching television, cable TV, you've probably seen ads for GameTap. Have you seen ads for GameTap? It's an online service that for lack of better words, it's kind of like a legitimate MAME or an emulator. Like, you can pull down old games, old... I'm not sure if it's just console games or it might also... It's arcade games. You can pull these down and play them on your system. I went to their website, and they had a Windows-only... It was only a Windows client. And they said they were working on a Mac client, so I sent them an email to the customer service and said, hey, you know... You guys considering a Linux client? Because I know there's a lot of gamers out there that run Linux that would probably love to use your service. And a day later, I got a response back from them that said, we're currently working on the OS X client. When we're finished with that, we're going to develop a Linux client.
That's so cool.
Yeah, that is cool. And I do highly recommend that you head over to GameTap.com, go to their customer service or support link, and send them an email to their customer service requesting a Linux client. You know, let them know that there are Linux users out there who will use the service or be interested in using a service
on Linux. Yeah.
They build it, you come.
That's right. I mean, you know, stuff like that we got to support in some way, too, if we want to see more services ported over to Linux.
Yeah, what Dan said.
And I guess one other thing I want to add for this week. Oh, you know, positive note. Another positive note. I upgraded to Breezy on the PowerBook here.
Breezy Bastard.
And two thumbs up. Was a smooth upgrade. And now the touchpad works. The function keys work. So I can actually use this.
And you got your wireless card, right?
And I got my wireless card working. Not the integrated, the USB adapter. I got that all working. So I can actually use it as a laptop now. I don't have to be, you know, all hooked up with a... external mouse and all sorts of stuff. So two thumbs up, it is working.
Yeah.
What time is it? Okay, I'm watching the time. One of the things that I've noticed and I had a problem with, and with my machine downstairs, which is running a Linksys wireless card using NDIS wrapper, and this machine here too, running the DWL, what is it, the 122?
Mm-hmm.
It's a USB 802.11b.
So you adapter. Haven't tried that new driver yet?
They don't have a version of that for Apple, for the PPC. Oh, look at that. My dinner has arrived.
Why wouldn't they have a version for PPC? It's the same code. Just compile it.
Yeah, but they said it doesn't run under the Apple Broadcom chipset yet. They do not sell... They do not have a binary for it, and you gotta, due to legal issues. Would you like a French fry?
No, thanks.
Thank you.
Well, I got a product review for you.
All right, hold on. Let me finish one thing. Now, the problem I have with these, the first one up here is the WLAN-NG drivers is what I have to use. They do not the script in there for initializing. The device doesn't work on the newer kernels with that DWL 122. So I had to write my own custom script. Because when you plug it in, it runs the hot plug will run the initialization script for that adapter.
Right.
It hangs my system a little bit. It, like my CPU process goes straight up to 99%. It can't connect to the device properly. I get all these error messages. But if I manually put in the commands to bring it up, connect to my base station and all that, it works. So I had to write a script to do that so I can have it automated. And then the problem I had was it wasn't coming up when I plug it in. I'd have to manually run that script. So I just put that script in the hot plug over there. So when I plug it in, the hot plug automatically runs that script and it brings it up just fine. Now with my wife's machine downstairs, using an NDIS wrapper, it's a PCMCIA card. Now, when the network comes up, initializes the network. Network gets initialized before the PCMCIA system gets initialized. So, it can't find the wireless network card. And it dumps out. Once it goes through the entire boot up, you can execute the process to... you can re-execute network because the wireless... card is now initialized because right. PCMCIA runs right. And an NDIS wrapper gets installed, it'll run.
Mm-hmm.
So I've been trying to figure out a way to get around this. What I did was just hack together a script that would at the end of the entire boot process, run just the DHCP, would load in the module and run DHCP.
Right.
So I was looking at this closer today, and the problem is on the way that the system boots up is all the those files, a good portion of the files, if you look in the init.d directory, is where all the scripts are. But if you look at your run level directory, there's a bunch of scripts that'll execute for your run level, but that's not all the scripts. There's a file called rcs.d that's in there, and in there are a ton of other scripts that are called from the default directory.
He should make mention that this is on Ubuntu.
And Debian too, I believe, does.
And Debian and a few other ones, and that's a System 5 kind of thing.
So the first time I went playing around
with
this,
much unlike Slackware,
I was pulling my head out trying to figure out why, when I dropped the PCMSIA to a low number in the startup, network still is getting initialized before that. And I'm looking through all those scripts trying to figure out where the hell is network being called from. It's being called from the default, rc.s.
Yep.
So what I ended up having to do, because I figured, okay, maybe I can figure out a way in the PCMSIA scripts, because that'll, if you have a network card in there, that'll run its own network initialization. But when I do the card control, I can't get device information for that card, which has a Broadcom chipset in it.
Mm-hmm.
I can't get that information out of there. So there's no, I can't figure out a way to put it in the PCMCIA scripts to have it automatically detected and run the necessary network protocols.
Why don't you just go to the PCMCIA init, and at the very bottom of the it's just a bash script. At the very bottom of the script, just link it to your script that starts up your card.
Yeah, I can do that, and I did do that, essentially, is what I do. But the problem is, if you update the system and it wants to update a new file, that file, you get that question, well, you edited this file. Do you want the new one or do you want the old one?
So put it in your – what's your default run level you normally run at?
It's 3 RC
or something?
Two.
Like
no.
2?
Ubuntu's 2.
All right, so you go into the RC2.d directory, and you make a file called S99 jerk-off.
No, actually, that's exactly what I did.
In there.
That's how I do it to initialize, but it would be nice if I can initialize it, if there was some way that would initialize
it
automatically.
It won't overwrite that way, so. That is automatic. What the hell are you talking about?
I mean, if there was a way I didn't have to hack together my own script to do it.
Everything is a script in Unix.
I know that, but I'm saying
what do
if
you
there was
want,
a way,
man? You want somebody to, you know,
wipe their ass for you?
He wants a boner and have somebody rub
no,
it too.
What
go
I,
use Linspire, Dan.
What?
Go use Linspire.
Man. All right, I will then.
You need to if you need
hey,
to
prop,
put a script
the Linspire,
in there, you put a
man.
Little script in there to do it.
I recently used the Linspire Live CD when I picked up my new laptops to try out to see, you know, if the wireless cards were recognized. And Linspire helped me make a decision on which machine to keep. Speaking of which, I got it right here. It's this Balance machine.
Pat swears by Linspire now.
Yeah. No, I don't use it. I got Arch running on this, man.
No, it's Canucks,
Pat Robinson.
Arch is running on this laptop, man. It's smoking.
It was running nice.
Oh, yeah.
Looks good. That laptop is a damn good-looking laptop, too.
Got KD 3.5. $550 from Walmart, man. Life is beautiful.
You know, you were saying in the KD 3.5 that there's something that about auto-configuring the menu.
Yeah.
Where is that?
Where is it? It's in, I'll tell you where it is. It's in settings under menu editor. It's menu updating tool.
Wait, I'm going to look at that here right now.
It's only on 3.5, though.
I'm running on 3.5. I'm there with you, Pat.
I got a menu editor on mine, and I'm
it's
running
called
XFCE.
VI, right?
No, I'm running XFCE. It's got a menu editor on there. So,
yeah, this $550 laptop, man, is probably marginally not as good as that Apple that you got on that desk there, Dan. It's probably coming from the same freaking factory in Taiwan or China, wherever the hell it's coming from.
Yeah, but I think your laptop is better looking.
So you're saying I go to
it's
which
got that
one?
Nice, like, you know, shiny black thing going on.
Settings.
Nice settings. And then I'm in the control
big
center.
Big screen.
Right?
Under, it's menu updating tool, but it's like, it's right in the middle on the menu editor. You don't have that?
Wait. I have to open up the configuration for the menu?
No. It's under settings.
Settings?
And then you got configure the panel, desktop settings wizard, menu editor.
This is a link over here. It's
right below menu editor. It's menu updating tool.
Come on, Alan. Let's you and me go out and have a shot of whiskey and a cigar.
Sounds good.
Well, wait a minute.
They're talking about their freaking KDE's.
KDE's great, man.
Stuff.
3.5 is
if you go to the
awesome.
K menu, you're talking about going to the K menu.
Yeah, wait, Alan
settings.
Runs KDE too. You all a bunch of pusses.
See it right here?
Yeah, but I don't screw around with mine like these guys do.
I don't have that.
I got it. What are you running?
Whatever came up with default in Slack is the way it came, maybe, is way it
maybe,
stays.
Maybe it's only on the Arch package.
I haven't even changed the background on this one yet.
You running Slack 2 on that yet?
10.2, yeah.
Interesting.
Yeah.
I'll have to maybe there's some
kind
of package
me and
I
Alan.
Need to install for that.
Only Alan needs to do this over here. He needs to run XFCE instead, which is better.
Yeah, but I like all the crap.
See, now,
eye candy.
Tux 1313 on the IRC says, Linus says use KDE. And yes, he does. Everybody read that article, I'm sure, where Linus Torvalds is saying that like you got to be on crack to use GNOME or whatever.
Well, that's true.
And I like GNOME better than KDE, just because I like the feel of it better, and KDE is a bit heavier. I understand that there's some, like, I don't know, whatever API issues or development issues they got going on. But I just wanted to make this one point. The reason that Linus Torvalds can say, go ahead and use KDE, is because he's got, like, the top-of-the-line equipment, man. For the rest of us peons, like I'm sitting here looking at my 400 megahertz laptop, do you have any idea how freaking slow KDE is on a 400 megahertz
you
laptop?
You can't run it on a 400 megahertz.
Yes, because I've run KDE on a 300 megahertz desktop.
Yeah.
Yeah. You gotta
go. Now, by the same token, you can't really run GNOME either.
Yeah.
You can get away with GNOME a little easier than you can get away with KDE, just a little bit. But, like, you know what? That's my whole point. Is it really easy for people to say that shit when they have, you know, top-of-the-line equipment. Oh, well, you know, he's got a freaking G5 Apple computer that he's running KDE on. Great. Fantastic. Me, my 400 megahertz Dell laptop, I'm running XFCE. Thank you very much. And it's better anyway, so...
I love KDE, man. It's fantastic. I like the integration. I like the applications that are available. The GTK apps look fine on it, and they run fine.
Same thing with XFCE. Yeah. I can run KDE and GTK.
I like XFCE.
Apps, and it's 14 times faster and requires only a third of the memory or less.
I'm trying to get into C++.
XFCE
program.
Reminds me of the hell that I have at work dealing CDE? With CDE. Yes. Yeah.
But, you know, the cool thing about it, how I describe XFCE
thankfully,
to
I don't
people,
have to anymore, but still.
How I describe XFCE to people who have used CDE, you know, like old Unix hacks.
It's the right way.
I told them it's CDE that works, you know.
Yes, yeah. I will agree with you there. It is nice, but I'm lazy. This is one of the options, you know, when you get to the last screen there during a Slack install where it's like, what do you want to run as your window manager? It's the first thing on there. Click.
Yeah, man, I saw XFCE. I was like, yeah, just select that one right there.
You're bringing out your dolls there?
Remember this? The Beauty and the Beast guy? Does it look like a drunken child molester?
Oh, yeah.
Oh.
Jellin is saying that on his 400 megahertz machine, P2, KDE 3.5 with Arch is really quick, he says.
He says I'm full of shit. I want to see it.
196 of RAM.
I want to see it. I want to see it because Judlin, man, I'm sorry to tell you this, but I think that the only reason that you're saying that is because you were trying to run it on a 166 megahertz machine before that, and you just think it's smoking.
Hey, just do a wink capture.
I don't
that.
Believe that, you know, KDE 3.5 runs like a bat out of hell on a 400
Judlin,
megahertz
machine.
Judlin,
open up your control center where it shows the processor and your memory and everything.
Give me your IP address and some, you know, VNC information. I'll get right in there, man.
He just needs to wink it.
He says,
wink it, baby.
He says, come on right over, Link. Yeah. You're only, what, 4, 5, 6 hours away?
You smack him in the face, Judlin.
Up in the snowy...
Don't take that from him.
The snowy winter wastelands of Canada, right?
But back to the laptop, man. I'm very happy with it, man. Best $550 I spent on a piece of hardware equipment. Very nice. I'm happy.
Yeah, baby. And I'm satisfied. I'm up
and
for
with
getting
the money
me a new
saved,
laptop.
He got a massage.
Soon. Yeah.
Right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I'm able to afford Christmas presents for my family.
That's good.
On spending too much money news, we are, again, looking at Microsoft Office licensing costs.
Oh, wow.
Why?
$64,000 a year.
Holy crap.
Why?
So I said to my boss, I said, look.
Tell him Open Office 2.0 works that's fine.
She said, that's the cost of doing business. And I said, let me just say something here. I said, look. Open Office, I use it every day. I've pretty much switched to using it as my primary office thing. Everything that comes into me, I open it up in Open Office. Everything works just fine. Unless they have some really funky formatting, which really crazy formatting, so which is fine. I said, look, all right, $64,000, and we can install it on our computer systems. That's all we have. But if we go over here, we look at OpenOffice 2, we can install it on every single computer. We can give it to our teachers. We can give it to every student that walks through this door. It opens up all the Office formats that I've ever tried. It's got all this functionality, all this power. Why don't we just like do some testing of this? Why don't we start seriously considering this? I mean, $64,000, we're free.
Yeah.
And if you want to buy Star Office, it's not going to cost you near as much as...
No shit. And they said it has better compatibility, right?
So. Right. It has some more proprietary filters and stuff like that in there.
Mm-hmm.
She said, well, what you need to do is you need to put together a proposal. You need to, you know, weigh the pros and the cons. You need to find out other businesses and school districts that have done this and what their experience has been and present it. So I got to put something like that together. Weigh the serious pros and cons. So if there's anybody out there who works in a business or a school district or whatever, or has inside information or any information that you can provide me.
Just contact the guys over at Open Office. I'm sure they'll give you a whole big thing.
They sent me an email about that a little while ago, and I really got to find that and get back in touch with them. But, you know, I'll tell you what. Like I said, I use this on a daily basis. For the PDF export alone,
right?
I was just thinking the same exact thing.
Yep, no kidding.
I got my wife.
I do that all the time.
Doing Open Office, and she loves the PDF export because she belongs to like the local moms club. She does the newsletter for them.
Mm-hmm.
So to distribute it, she converts it to PDF. Just for that alone, she uses it Open Office, and she loves it.
Well, I'll tell you what. I have not used Microsoft Office in several years. I've been strictly, I've gone through all of the Microsoft Office viewing programs, starting back when it was, you know, Star Office that was free. And I was happy with it then, and it's done nothing but get better as time goes along. Not only Open Office, but, you know, there's some other alternatives too. There's Numeric for spreadsheets, and there's Abbey Word for opening up documents, and they've all gotten better as well. But this new version of OpenOffice, the OpenOffice 2.0, just astounds me. It's wonderful how cleanly it will deal with Microsoft documents.
Yeah,
not only importing them but exporting them too. So I really dig it. Like I said, that's the only thing I use. I haven't used anything other than open source stuff for many, many moons now. And, and I work in a business environment. I work in a big multi-conglomerate corporation, you know, a direct marketing company. We have all these, you know, it's a big umbrella company, all these other companies. So not only am I just doing Open Office documents and translating them and sending them back and forth to people just in my portion of the company, but, you know, all over the world, these people are that I send stuff to. And I never have a problem. I never have anybody call me up and tell me, you know, oh, Link, can you reformat that document because I can't read it right in Microsoft Word or something like that. They open it right up, and I don't have a problem, you know, getting anything that they send up to and including the, that presentation software.
PowerPoint,
yes. Even including PowerPoint presentations, they can send them to me. And interestingly enough, I got one the other day, a PowerPoint presentation that my the facility manager where I work could not open it up. And he has Microsoft Office 2000, right? He could not open up the PowerPoint presentation. So he sent it to me. I opened it up in OpenOffice and printed it out for him so that he could have a copy of it. Go figure, right? OpenOffice wins up over Microsoft on its own
documents. We did this once with some of our manuals at work, most of our manuals at work were all done in Word.
Mm-hmm.
It'd been the same template that had been modified over and over and over again until it got to a point where it just didn't work half the time.
Mm-hmm.
I opened it up in OpenOffice, and you can see all the formatting that gets hidden.
Uh-huh.
And the tables and crap that was all over. Like, people would put down text boxes, and then the next person would come along, decide, oh, I don't
just
need this.
Just delete the text?
No, they would just hide the whole text box back over. And so you'd have these text boxes on top of text boxes and tables on top of tables that had just been smushed up into nothing. It was hilarious.
And so all that stuff is just building in a template, and you end up with a 900 meg template, right?
Exactly. And then wondering why you get 50 pages into it and completely freeze on you.
Nifty.
Unfortunately, they're still stuck in Microsoft products, but it's their money. I can't change them. They don't listen to me.
Well, that's what I tell my company, too. But you know what? I also take great care and pains in reminding them every time they come to me to fix a document or translate a document so that they can use it again, that I am fixing it on a Linux box.
Yes.
And not using Microsoft software. So, believe me, I enjoy the hell out of doing that.
Out of doing that, yes, I know.
And it's all because I, finally had a cool boss a while back who said, I don't really give a crap what operating system you run, just as long as you can get your work done. So,
yeah, I wish I had that.
So, ba-dum-bum.
We're going to talk to our guest.
I guess it's time.
Paul Ferris.
Yep.
The Batch Login Project.
No, I just want to go smoke.
Go ahead, man. Smoke up.
Smoke the bone.
Don't get up, man.
Fire it up.
Don't get up, man.
Wait, which one am I supposed to call?
Pass me that. Well, yeah,
try the landline first. Then we'll try the cell phone. Try to avoid the cell phone if possible. What are you using? You using X10?
Mm-hmm.
Hello?
Paul Ferris.
Hi, Paul.
Yes.
Hi, it's Dan Washko from the Linux Link Tech Show.
Yeah, let's try calling back on my landline.
Oh, okay. I'm sorry, this is the number Pat gave me. All right, I'll call you right back, okay?
No problem. You got that phone number right?
Yeah.
Okay, I'll wait. No problem.
All right, bye.
Dan, trying to pin it on me.
Wait a minute.
There's two numbers on there.
The first number was his cell.
Apparently. Whatever number you just called, he said, call me on my landline.
The first number I have here then has two dashes. It says cell fairly clean. And then 3-3. Am I going to say what the number is? Let me mute it.
Yeah, that probably wouldn't be a good idea. So we're coming up on Christmas, guys. What kind of great techie Christmas gifts are we all wishing for? That's what I want to know.
I got my gift.
Yeah, you got a laptop. That's what I want too.
That's my gift to me.
I'm gonna get me one of them, I think. Because, my laptop is seen better. It's in good shape, but it's a little on the slow side for me now. Except for you guys who keep telling me that you can run supercomputing facilities on this thing if you would just install Arch on it. So I might have to try that.
You can run multiple clusters off of it.
Damn it.
Anything is possible.
Uh-huh.
Vladster wants a eunuch.
Paul, is that better?
Yeah, that much better.
Oh, great.
Take the cell in combination with everything.
Paul, just to let you know, we are running live right now.
Okay.
So
any dirty words you might say will go right out on the air with all the dirty words that we have just said.
Crud. There.
All right.
We're going to get here.
So we're talking with Paul Ferris tonight, who is the developer of the Linux batch login process, or just the batch login process?
Batch login. It's a project I wrote for basically managing large enterprise-class groups of servers in high-security situations, like, say, if you got trouble transferring data or running programs, say, through multiple firewalls, you can configure the thing to basically hop into any kind of complex situation. It also does things, really weird things, like manage multiple accounts, multiple data stores for where the account data is stored. So say you've got your root password in one sensitive area, say vaulted in a network vault, it can combine that along with, say, four or five sets of user credentials to get you, you know, through different sets of hops and into, you know, where the work needs to be done. So it's not the kind of thing most people have had to face, but I've had to use Linux in some really, really complex scenarios, and it's been where I've made my living the past 3 or 4 years. And so this was a thing that solved that problem and a lot more. So does that explain it?
Because I was looking over your website and everything, and this seems to be a really handy tool that if you said, like, you can manage a lot of systems with it, couldn't you?
Right.
And, like, you
where
can...
Where I was at, there's about 1,000.
Okay. It could be almost, in a sense, you could say one purpose you could use this for would be if you needed to run an update on all your systems, you could use batch login to perform that and push that update out.
Yes. For example, I was using it today. I was collecting some data from about 120 systems, and I just had a little shell script that collected the data for me. And rather than having to have the script NFS mounted somewhere or secure copy it there, batch login actually takes care of transferring the script through the shell connection, running it, and then deleting it. So I don't have to worry about cleaning up the junk when I'm all done or having it, having to transport a script. It's a very, very simple little thing that way. Plus, if for example, if I had, say, 20 of the servers were in some weird, demilitarized zone behind a firewall, I could just, in one little small step, say, okay, you don't just log into these servers. You log in here and then log into the server and then SU to root, because you typically in an enterprise-class environment, you're not allowed to log in directly as root. So maybe, that's three steps, and you can just say to batch login, okay, here are the three steps to manage these, 20 servers, and takes care of all of that and transfers all the data, runs it, It's really, really cool that way. It solves me a lot of problems.
Now, here's a quick question for you. When you're doing the batch login process, is the stuff running consecutively or concurrently, or...
It's a serial process the way that it's configured right now for doing the stuff I just described, because it's nice to have a log file that tells what's been done. There's an alternative way to use it for shell prompts that's called batch login terminal, or BLT, not to be confused with bacon, lettuce, and tomato. And BLT, it would allow you to open concurrent sessions. You don't want 100 windows popping open on your screen, so typically it's when you have, like, clusters of servers. I've had to work with clusters before a lot, so typically there are groups of maybe at max 8, and it'll open 8 windows with no problem, and then you can even have your shells execute weird stuff in those in parallel in that scenario, for example. Does this make sense?
Yeah. So is there with the batch login, is there a... like a client that needs to be running on the remote machines, or?
That's one of the beautiful things, is it's all managed from a central spot, so you don't have to do any kind of pushing out clients to anything. Its unit of work is a shell prompt. So, no.
Okay.
kind of neat that way. And it runs from a central location. It's currently ported Solaris, Linux, and SigWin, which is not the cleanest port I've ever seen. I still have issues with SigWin, but it works for the most part.
Is it essentially a... You know, every time I hear somebody say bash login, I'm thinking of bash login. So it's more than just a script.
Oh, it's huge. It's about two parts expect, and maybe another half part corn shell, and then the rest of the work is the heavy lifting is encryption done by OpenSSL. That's another thing. Bash login uses a whole bunch of encrypted configuration, and I used Blowfish. You have to actually enter a password to unlock the configuration that you use to do the automation.
So then, essentially, what you could do is just download this thing, install it, and start maintaining your systems immediately.
It takes a bit to set up. That's the biggest hurdle. Right now, I'm trying to work on a way to make it easier to set up. It's just a matter of picking a central spot for it to run for yourself or for your group of people that are managing your systems. And then you basically, what's nice is, like, for me, I could make configurations that people could import for, say, a group of servers, and then they would edit a particular file that defined maybe their login credentials, and the rest of it they would be able to manage, you know, using my data, leverage my connection data. And that's like when you have lots of people doing it, typically only one person really needs heavy configuration lifts.
So would this be something that would be like in the same league as, what is it, Red Carpet, or what is Novell's product, ZenWorks?
You're probably, when you look at stuff like that, it's for, you know, patching large numbers of systems is what you're talking about, right?
Patching, managing.
Yeah, those are great for, like, from my experience, they're great for fairly flat networks. You have to, they have, like, clients that install that do a lot of the lifting for you. One of the nice things about batch login is it's kind of Linux, Unix generic, so you can do things like write a script that'll run on just about anything. And, you know, like where I was at, there was AIX, Solaris, HQX, Linux. And I just wrote stuff that used the uname function to say, okay, I'm going to do this when I'm on this box. And it's great.
And how long did it take you to write this?
I wrote it in an enterprise class setting to solve several problems at once. And it was probably about 6 months for the last version that I wrote, a good portion of it for a project. And when I left that company, they gave it away. They made it GPL at that point so that I could support it.
So they were pretty open to making it GPL?
I requested it, and they thought it was a great idea. So, yeah, I would say that's correct. You know, there's a lot of misconception about how things end up, you know, under the GPL. I mean, some people think of it like it's charity. And in this particular case, I assure you that this company was very financially focused. and the idea was, you know, very beneficial to them and me, both. That's the thing about open source software that a lot of people are missing, or free software, is that it just makes sense. It's nothing to do with charity, really. I mean, it would be nice if people were very, very humanitarian. I like to think they are. I like to be that way myself. But from my experience of talking to lots of people that have been involved in you know, free software, it just makes sense, and that's how it ends up happening. And backlogging is no exception.
So when you run this, you actually have to have a password list.
Right.
And that would be like a link without actually looking through the documentation, because, you know, the way you operate is you start using it, then you look at the documentation.
When you have
a
figure
question.
It out, yeah.
Yeah. You run the help command, just the H, and then you say, well, what the hell does that mean? And then you look up the documentation. So I'm looking here. So you have some kind of password list. And
right. It's
an encrypted password list, obviously.
Correct.
And is that like a, you got your password list, it's a the relationship to like an IP address of the machine?
And, sort of. Let me explain a little bit of a high-level view. Let's take a typical scenario. You log into a machine. Maybe you've got 100 machines that are very similar, okay? They're all in the same spot on the network, okay?
Right.
And let's say they all have the same root password, but you can't get onto them as root. You've got to get on them as you first, okay?
Right.
So what you can do with batch login is you can define those two steps for each server with a specific configuration line, and where your login goes, you can reference an external encrypted file that says, use this login and this password. And that's just done with some labeling. And then the next line where you're connecting to the server, there's the jump onto the machine as you, and then the next line would be SU to root. And those two lines are connected with some reference syntax. And there, you know, your root password again, you don't want to repeat your root password 100 times. So again, you use another label, and maybe you point to yet another encrypted file that's separate. That way, when you share your configuration with someone else, the password list itself that defines the servers is separate from the password list that defines your root password, which is separate from the password list that defines your login account information, which both of those files, the last two I mentioned, might be really simple. They might just say, okay, my login is Paul and my password is, you know, ABC123, God forbid. Okay? So it can be really simple, those last two configuration files. And you can, when you send out your configuration to your team, it has this big long list of servers in it with these reference labels saying, okay, you know, your ID goes here kind of thing. And they take and encrypt that file, and then they encrypt two more files. You make them get the root password from wherever the company has said their root passwords are stored. This is always a bone of contention, you know. I mean, if the company's doing the thing right, they'll have some kind of a password vaulting software. But my experience has been that, you know, it's written in a book somewhere, or John knows it. You know what I mean?
It's on a piece of paper on top of the monitor.
Right, Funk and Wagnall's front porch. So, I mean, it's that kind of thing where, you know, I typically have it set up just like I described. That way, when I need to add a new server, I'm maintaining a list of servers in one file, and I never really hardly ever look at the rest of the data. My login account is encrypted and changed maybe monthly, and the root password changes on whatever interval it does, and the rest of it I don't have to worry about. The configuration takes care of that. In other words, it documents clearly how I got there from here kind of thing and what account information I used, and it allows me to keep that locked away.
Makes sense.
Now, it does some other weird stuff, too, if you really want to hear about it.
Sure. Go.
Okay.
Go right ahead.
One of the other problems you run into in large deployments of servers, if they don't use anything like NIS or LDAP configuration for their IDs, which I've seen this done, you run into an issue like, you know, if passwords are actually aging, your account might go bad in 30 days, for example. And now you've got another scenario, which is you'd really like your password to change on a regular basis, but you may not necessarily be in control of the interval of when that happens or whatever. So what you can do in batch login is you can actually say, hey, try this username and password, and if that fails, try this next one. And if that one works, it senses that it's got an old configuration, and it actually prompts you to update the password and heal it. And you can make it do that even automatically. So in other words, it sort of just takes care of all of the mismatched user account type stuff that you might run into in a typical large enterprise scenario where, you know, you have various unices with different, you know, capabilities.
All right. When are you going to be using it, Link?
I don't need it. I don't have anything anywhere. See, that's the thing. I'm trying to figure out, you know, what size business would actually need to use something like this. I mean, I have a lot of servers and stuff, but...
Can probably 20 to 30 is where it starts to get useful.
Can I work there?
Yeah. Huh? Can I work there?
Can I go work for them?
You know, the thing that I've taken for granted in my career lately has been that this stuff just keeps happening in larger quantities. but I mean, you know, there's a mix here. I mean, a trade-off. As things get large like this, you run into a whole new class of problems that you didn't have before. And, you know, the biggest issue in enterprise-class scenarios is you end up with more admins, and anytime you talk, like, say, 10 or 15 admins working on, say, 100 servers, you're talking serious chaos. So that I have a totally different set of solutions for that would take most of the night, you know, to describe. But it's what I've been doing. I really love what I do. Like, I have been very blessed in the past few years to have large problems to solve and come up with very creative ways of solving them. And this is just one of those examples.
That's pretty cool.
So you work as a sysadmin, or are you a programmer?
My actual title, I think they call me a system administrator where I'm at, but really what I'm doing is engineering and architecture work for the company I'm at right now.
And that would be network engineering you're talking about?
No, it's there's an actual OS engineering essentially You know, I try to design automation to manage the things instead of actually, you know, logging in and fixing problems. That would be an operational role, more of a sysadmin type work is people that take the stuff that I've done and apply it, you know, follow the documentation. I write a lot of documentation and I write a lot of programs. But yeah, programming is a big part of my job.
Oh. So you're working on the heavy-duty automation tools.
I love automation. Actually, what I've done right now is apply, we're building servers without human intervention. If we need a particular class of server, we can reconstitute it from automation. And everything's done with RPMs. So, for example, maybe...
How unfortunate for you.
Huh?
I said, how unfortunate for you.
Oh, you probably are a Debian guy.
Slackware.
Slackware. Okay. Well, I understand your grief. The matter is that one of the beautiful things about RPM technology in terms of bolting up with change control... this has been one of my experiences, is that that as you get into hundreds of servers, it's nice to know what's been done to what. And the RPM command allows you to list all of the installed RPMs. And so all the changes done to a server are done via RPM. And that means you can also, if you've written your RPM correctly, back those changes out just by removing the RPM. And you can then, you know, get an inventory of just what state each server is in. You can tell... You know, MD5 checksums of all the files. It's a beautiful thing. I know, I understand the whole philosophy behind Slackware. I've met Patrick Volkerding on a few occasions. He's a great guy. But I mean, it's more of a free flowing OS for people that really know what they're doing. As you get into large quantities of servers, it's nice to know exactly what's been done and have an audit trail and be able to do and undo at will. And that's why we're using RPM.
Now, I guess are you primarily working with Red Hat Enterprise Linux?
Right now, I did the prior job. Right now I'm using SUSE Enterprise Linux, or Novell is what it's being branded as now.
Interesting.
Doesn't matter to me. Does it have a command prompt?
That's
all I care about.
SUSE. Now, is your company, are you developing this the automation for internal use, or is it actually a commercial product?
Oh, no, this is strictly for the company, and it's very much tailored to their kind of work and strictly for building servers to their order. So it's a great thing for when we need to make similar systems, we can leverage all of the work that we did to make a system that's very much like one but maybe has a slightly different configuration. If you do your RPMs right and the way your automation is done, you kind of have like a matrix of potential values that might make the potential number of different servers buildable in the thousands of different servers, but maybe the company only needs a specific small cross-section of those servers. Like maybe in our particular case, I'm thinking probably the type of different servers is maybe 40 or 50 in use right now, but you don't know. I mean, a particular class of server in a particular, you know, tier might get need to be created, and now you've got your RPMs all set up to do that, and there it is.
Now, do you think that this company... Oh, I'm sorry. Go ahead.
Could you repeat that question?
Oh, what I was going to ask was, do you think this company would be open to releasing what you're working on as an open source project, if there is something you could actually release?
Pieces of it might end up that way. The actual philosophy, I've been told to do a white paper on it and speak about it at next year's Ohio Linux Fest. So you'll hear about it, and there may be pieces of it that we get to release, but a good portion of it would be totally useless to anyone else. It's hard to describe.
Okay. Are you in the eastern / central United States?
I am in Ohio.
Oh, well, you're not too far from us.
Where are you guys at?
Lehigh Valley, Bethel, Allentown, Easton area of Pennsylvania, about 50 miles
cool.
north of Philadelphia.
Okay. I just drove, I drove through, is it anywhere near Route 80?
More 78, closer to 78.
Yeah, it's just not that, we're not near Route 80, we're about what? No, I'm thinking 81.
We're about 30 miles south of 80.
Yep.
Yeah.
Okay. I came near you guys recently. Had to go to Sterling Forest, New Jersey.
New Jersey? Yeah, just pretty much drove right past us.
That's where they do the Renaissance Festival every summer.
Yeah, I
You were there for the Renaissance?
No, I was there for a disaster recovery drill. So, IBM has a facility. It was quite an interesting drill. So, yeah, it's beautiful territory, definitely, where you guys are at. And right now, it's probably very interesting. Are you guys getting snow? Because we are right now.
No, but we'll probably be getting it soon. I think we're supposed to poor weather either tomorrow night, or is it tomorrow?
Snow, sleet stuff tomorrow, yep.
Yeah, and then you got those nice hills to drive on. So, but yeah. It's beautiful.
You know, the ice hasn't even melted out in front of my house yet. It's on the street, on the... sidewalks. It's a mess.
Slippery.
Yeah.
Careful.
Stinks. So disaster recovery drill.
Yep.
What do you do there? I mean, what happens?
Well, we try and reconstitute as much as we can in as short a time as possible. So it's I probably can't really talk much more about it than that.
Speaking of disasters, John Gorzin, remember John? You know, the guy who wrote the Python books? He's a Debian developer. The company where he works for, I think it's Indiana, they had like a really bad fire, and he's like rebuilding the whole infrastructure there.
Rebuilding all of Python?
No. At his company, the IT department was like that major fire, and they, like, check out his blog if you get a chance, John Grosen's blog. Let me post the link in the IRC.
All right. Now,
yeah, if you don't have everything backed up and you don't do regular drills, then. You know, you may find it can be very, very much a lot more work than you might imagine. I've seen both sides of the fence here. I've seen really big loss where people thought stuff was really being backed up, and it turned out it wasn't. And I've seen what we do. And it's good to have a good run at things and see what it's like. See what you really have backed up. Can you really bring it back? And do you have really good procedures? And you get into large deployments of stuff, anything. It isn't just Linux where I'm at. And you need people that really are thinking that way. So
this wasn't something where you got to take... You obviously took your copies of your existing backup, and was that it, restored it? Or was it something where you actually built something up, and then you got to destroy it, and then you got to restore it again?
They actually have hardware and everything set up, and they actually have mirrored-type operations going on, and, you know... I don't want to talk more specific than that, but essentially it's very, very well thought out what they're doing to make sure that the company's operations will continue even if a particular data center is wiped out. And that's really good stuff. It certainly opened my eyes as to what's involved in making sure that your continuity is good.
I can guarantee that you don't work for the same company I do.
Wow.
100% guarantee that.
So yeah, I like what I do. It's really creative. A lot of the stuff I get to do is they pretty much listen to what I have to say a lot of times and turn me loose. And I think that's something to be said for that.
That doesn't sound like your company.
It doesn't sound like my company either. They don't listen to a damn thing, I have to say. Not until after it breaks. After it breaks, like the day after we have a major fire at my company and there's no backups, then they're going to come to me and say, you know, oh, Link, well, what can we do to fix this? And I'm going to say, well, you remember 8 months ago when I emailed you about that redundant backup system?
That's what you turned to.
That you said was too much money?
That's what you turned to him and say, shoulda, coulda, east woulda.
Yep.
You know, I used to actually have a philosophy where this is going to date me here now, but in the early 90s, I worked for a company where I was responsible for, it was something like 6 gigabytes of data. It wasn't huge. this is back when that was a lot of data, and I backed it up onto, I think they were 2 gig tapes at the time.
Floppies.
And I never reused a tape.
Floppy shit.
I just numbered a new set and put it in a drawer and had those shipped down to a particular location that was outside of our data center.
Mm-hmm.
And one day the vice president of the company came into my office and said, you know, you've spent a lot of money on backup tapes. And he's starting to read me the riot act, and I had about half the tapes in my drawer. You know, mm-hmm. I pulled the drawer open and we did a count, and he looked down there and he said, yeah, that's around $3,000 worth of backup tape. And I looked at him and I said, that's not what I see there. And he goes, what do you mean? I said, I see several million dollars worth of unreplaceable data.
That's what I tell them, too. They're like, well, we don't want to spend $500 on those hard drives. And I'm like, okay, well, you can spend $5 million on the client data that you've contracted to keep for the next 6 years, you know?
Right. Right.
Well, and then the tune changes, right?
Bad tape, you know? Yeah. Or one bad drive, you know? This doesn't make sense. The media is nowhere near the cost. It used to be really expensive, but it ain't that way anymore.
But you know what? The suits in the world don't. No, they don't want to know anything about backups until after the disaster has occurred.
Yeah.
That's what
I think.
You
have to be able to sell them on the whole concept. And I wish I could say that I've always done that, but I've been fortunate to work with people that did it.
Well, you know how you do that, right? You know how you sell them on disaster recovery?
You get these mainframe people.
You sell them on disaster recovery, you go in there and you cut the power.
I know. I work in a mainframe environment.
Wait until the middle of the day when everybody's working, cut the power and say, okay, now... What would happen if the building just blew up? What would you need?
And then they start to think.
Yep.
Okay. Yeah, I was just saying mainframe people because they've been around these problems forever, and they tend to have a very, very good set of vocabulary for explaining and already having done it and stuff. But isn't always the case. That's just a general statement. I've just noticed that they tend to have their stuff together.
Mm-hmm.
There, I didn't swear.
You could swear, it's okay.
Well, not that one. So, it's good stuff. You got to really plan that stuff out and sell it to the business and explain the value of it. It's not a bad idea to have a drill if you can.
Yeah, I have a drill, cross my fingers. Right. No, actually, I do. You know, My
drill consists of bending in half and kissing my ass. That's what my drill consists of.
Beep.
Oh, shit. Here we go.
Shit.
There's two.
Link, you'll be working like
that.
There
it goes.
Yeah.
Where's that tape?
So, this will get spooled onto the internet, and then the FCC won't be involved. That's how that works, right?
Yep, fuck the FCC. That's what we say.
Fuck the FCC, fuck the RIA, fuck the MPAA.
Thank you, Pat, for that explicit tag.
You're welcome.
Hey, well, we got the explicit tag on our, what is it, on iTunes, right? why not give them a reason to keep it on
Let's
there?
Use it, man. We got the luxury. Let's abuse it. Let's use it.
We'll test that disaster recovery.
That's right.
We've had our disasters here. The power goes out.
When they're knocking on our door.
Wait, speaking of disasters, yeah, everybody still remembers last week. It's fresh in their memory, right, Dan?
That was pretty mild, actually.
What kind of day? What
more you want to know about batch logging or anything like that? Or there's a very small piece with batch logging that has to do with SecureX window access that I wrote as well.
Oh, talk about that, because I saw that listed on the website.
It's the RPMs for both of them are broken for SigWin. You have to install from source. But essentially, the SecureX thing, if you've ever used something like Hummingbird, Exceed, or Reflections X, or anything that does X window access to other servers, what SecureX is a very small, lightweight connector to the SigWin X server that lets you securely do very much the same thing that most people use those products for, which is basically tunnel an entire X window session through SecureCell. And I use it daily to connect to several servers in our environment. And all I use is, you know, SecureCell with my ID. And it's a very, very simple setup. I've been hoping somebody would get involved in maybe fix it a little better than it is. But it's good enough for me, you know, right now.
Does that work in conjunction with your existing X server, or do you have to run a specific X server?
It uses SigWin. SigWin's got an X server built into it.
Oh.
So you don't need to, like, buy, you know, anything else. You can just use SigWin. If you download SigWin's X server and this piece of software, you can... Say, for example, say you have an AIX box in your environment, you could actually securely display the entire windowing environment right on your Windows desktop, similar to what you'd use, say, Reflections or Hummingbird Exceed for.
You know, it's been so long since I've actually used SigWin. I'm talking like maybe 5-6 years.
Oh, God, it's gotten so much better.
Oh, yeah?
Oh, yeah.
Now,
I mean, and they've ported everything to it. It's almost like having a Linux distribution. I'm serious. It's like OpenLDAP and Apache. You know, there's so much stuff in there, it's frightening.
Now, if you're running that SigWin environment like that, can you actually run Windows applications through there?
Yeah, you can call them.
You can call
them? They'll come up as Windows applications, unfortunately.
Oh, but they won't show remotely then, will they?
Right, exactly. The cool stuff that X does for you, forget it. Get in there. But,
then you'd have to run VNC or something.
Right. It what I end up doing every once in a while, like, for example, XFCE, my Windows XFCE environment, because XFCE has been ported to SigWin, comes up, and when I hit the file manager icon, I get a Windows file manager inside my Windows environment, and it comes up over the top of X Windows. But everything that I pick X Windows based inside there comes up fine.
Oh, okay. That's pretty cool.
It's a beautiful piece of work, I'll tell you. They've even ported Corn Shell to it, which that was pretty much what sealed it for me, because I write most of my stuff in Corn Shell. I like Corn Shell over Bash. It's nothing personal against Bash. It's just that most of the time I'm in a mixed environment where Bash is not necessarily available, and I like my scripts to just run. And I do know the actual difference in syntax. Most people probably don't do things like use arrays or anything like that, but I do in my shell script.
Yeah. Man, I remember using SigWin to do automation on a Windows machine.
Hello?
Hello? Hello? Hello?
Perhaps we got cut.
Can you hear us? Oh, no. Oh, noes. Can you hear me?
Can you hear me now? Can you hear me now?
We're still connected.
I think we lost.
I don't know. Should I hang up and call him back?
Too much bandwidth.
I think we lost him.
Hello? How could that happen?
Who knows, man?
Let me call him back.
Could have been a problem with the VoIP carrier.
You call him back just to tell him goodbye, right?
Pretty much.
We're pretty much here for the interview is spent.
It's not. Now I gotta get back to. I gotta mute it.
So you can dial, and no one hears the nobody hears the dial digits.
Oh,
do 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 do.
Hmm. Wonder what happened there.
It's dead, Jim.
Shit happens, man. Hey, any of you guys running Firefox 1.5?
My father-in-law is.
Hey, have any issues?
I'm running on a Windows box.
Yeah, he hasn't told me anything about it yet.
Some people have reported issues.
I'll hear it.
Paul.
Yeah, we lost you.
I don't know what happened there. I heard you saying, are you guys still there? Are you still there? I don't know. Maybe Alan screwed something up. I apologize for that.
No problem.
Just put me on the spot there.
Yeah, I was just saying that when I was talking, I was like, yeah, I remember using Sigwin to do some automation on a Windows machine that I couldn't do any other way, or I couldn't. It was so much easier to do it through Sigwin than trying to figure out how to do a little Windows scripting.
Well, you know, Awk is very hard to beat, bang for the buck, you know, or even the shell. There's so many things that are in there that have been very well thought out, and you can spend many lines of other languages trying to do what you can do in a couple lines of shell script. So, just from my experience.
Yeah, that's the truth. We got to get Link to use self scripting. He likes to run that Visual Basic stuff.
Yeah, that's what it is.
He's not going to impress the women that way.
Nothing about that shell scripting.
Yeah, he's our .NET developer.
Ugh.
So what are you using at home then? Are you using
Straight Linux.
Allstate.
I said Straight Linux.
Oh, Straight Linux.
Yeah, I don't have any proprietary software on my LAN.
None at all.
None.
No apples, no nothing.
Nothing. Just Linux.
Good man.
Now this is a good guy right here. That's the right answer to have.
I just like the stability and the fact that I know it's in there. It's not going to report back to some company in the northeast corner of the country saying, hey, you know, he's whatever. it's a nice comfortable feeling, and you know, I don't have to rebuild my servers all the time, and what's this malware stuff, I don't ever have to worry about that. I've got my brother and my dad using this stuff, same story. They see the value. It's starting to happen, I think, more than just to my, you know, the bigots like us are not as unique as we used to be.
Now, how hard was it to get your other family members switched over to Linux?
This year, it was very easy. I can't say this year. I guess it was last year in December. I gave my brother a Linux box, and he was so fed up with the virus problem and the adware problem that he didn't need any more convincing. And he's actually been working on his friends at work, and they've been doing, you know, From what he tells me, they've been going out to like Best Buy and these places that actually have Linux boxes, you know, ordering from Walmart online, and it's just, you know, word of mouth starting to really make it happen. I don't think it's uncommon anymore. You just start to see people who are just tired of it. But let's face it, a typical Windows PC has become such a liability on a broadband connection, and that's very, very common. That a lot of people are simply unable to own them anymore. I mean, I just recently heard of a lady. She had a $150 bill to clean viruses off her computer, and she couldn't pay it. And, I mean, you know, a new PC is like $300. In other words, her PC was totaled by viruses.
I have billed people that much myself to do that.
You're an evil prick.
Yeah. Seriously, if you're fixing somebody's computer, they want to have that computer fixed. I tell them straight up, you know, I charge them like $40-$50 an hour to do it. And it might take, you know, five hours to rebuild their damn computer. So,
yep.
It costs them a lot of money. And he's absolutely right. It's cheaper for them to go to, you know, Kmart and buy another $400 PC and bring it home.
It's sad.
Or you can buy 20 minutes of extra internet time and download a Ubuntu CD or something like that, install it on there, and be good. You know,
I've got a guy at work during the buy a new PC this weekend because of that.
Well, make sure that he brings his old one in for us, man.
Because of Ubuntu, because of viruses.
Yeah, I mean, let's face it. A lot of people just need a PC to surf the web and check their email.
Sure.
It's become an internet appliance for most people. There's a whole gaming community, of course, and there are some people that actually run Windows-based software, but they're less and less than they used to be. And you know, there's a whole lot of stuff on the internet. What Google is doing to with their search engine on the internet makes it an entire application base that rivals, you know, utility value that you might get elsewhere. And I think it's a matter of just inertia. There will come a tipping point where people see a value in just having Linux for just the sheer security of it. And I think we're very, very close to where that is. The fact that I'm seeing, you know, people that are not people that I've convinced to do this, doing it, tell me that it's not as far away as we thought it would be.
I can see that. And it's getting better all the time.
Well, Ubuntu, as you mentioned, it's very, very easy to use. I was very impressed at how simple they laid it out.
You running Ubuntu over there?
I've shown people it at work. I'm so geeky. It's, you know, my main reason to use a window environment is for multiple shell windows. Terminal windows.
That's what I use it for, too.
Hey, a GUI's useful for something. There it is.
So what are you running over there?
I like XFCE on top of Fedora, believe it or not. That's what I use.
Another XFCE guy. See, guys? That's what I'm using, too. And everybody thinks that I'm crazy.
What
XFCE
are you talking about?
Is awesome.
I use XFCE on the Archbox.
XFCE is nice.
I use Window Maker on one machine at work.
But you use KDE on your main workstation.
There, and I use Fluxbox right here. I like to spread myself around.
Yeah.
Get familiar with it.
That's what we heard about you, Dan. You like to spread yourself around.
I said KDE is really nice, but what I hate about it is when I open a shell window, it just has that extra delay.
Oh, yeah. We're talking about that last night.
I was just mentioning that last night. Everybody thinks I'm crazy.
On this machine, it's smoking, man.
Yeah, but when I open up a terminal window... Yeah, when I open up a terminal window, that's the one thing that bothers me. When I open up a terminal window, I want it to open right then.
Yes.
I can't wait 4 seconds.
Under KDE, it's like doing all these... Tom, you know, you can tell it's doing like object-oriented C calls. You know,
sure, yeah.
Font right and all this crap, and under XFCE, it's like, oh yeah, bang. You have your window.
Because that's what, you know, that terminal window is my portal into my computer. I need to have that open when I want it open, you know?
Right. Right.
For definitely. Those of us who write unreliable bash scripts.
Now look, watch. You can see it pop up over there. Watch. That's eterm. Comes up really fast.
Right.
But if I use... Where is the damn thing?
Console or something like that?
Terminal?
K-O-N-S-O-L-E.
See, that takes like, what, 2 seconds to pop up compared
to
the other
that's
one?
That's GNOME term, right?
What?
GNOME term, that's what you want to know?
I don't know what it is.
Yeah.
If you watch what console's doing, too, it's doing some sort of callback to the toolkits for, you know, QT and all kinds of stuff. And
sure, they're checking all kinds of little API things and... It's just too much for me. Now, however, I have used like KDE and stuff and just, you know, put the default terminal to like Xterm or something. That's all right.
Yeah,
but
that's not too bad. I know what you're talking about. But Xterm has vulnerabilities in it. No, I'm just kidding. Yeah. They've even ported Secure Shell Daemon to Sigwin, believe it or not. You can have your Windows box answer Secure Shell requests.
Now, that's an idea, but you know, here's a dumb question, right? If you're going to run all of that crap under Sigwin on a Windows machine, why the hell just don't you install Unix on it and get it over with, you know? What's the last little piece of holdout thing there?
I've been stuck in an
IT department
where
usually.
I was not allowed to use the toolkit that I thought was right for the job. In other words, my laptop was not... It was issued with... You know, particular class of Windows software, and that was it. If I got caught running anything at like Linux on it, I would be fired. So that's when you patch it with Sigwin.
Wow, why would they fire you for running Linux?
I really don't want to talk about the company in a negative light.
Okay.
That was their policy, and that I adhered to it. But, and, you know, once I got Sigwin on there and say XFCE, didn't matter to me. That was where I, that's where I lived, and I got my work done.
Now, what about doing things today? Like, they have, you know, today you don't even have to install Linux on your hard drive. You can run it off a pen drive or something like that, or
right,
just a CD-based distribution, and, you know, tell the commie bastards to go pound sand, you know, pretty much.
Well, what they would do is they'd actually scan the network and use a fingerprinting tool to tell what you're running.
Aha. Uh-huh.
Yeah. And then they would identify basically your MAC address or something like that and come back and say, you know, you're out of here. And I really, you know, I have enough Linux at home. That's where I get my joy, you know, go to work. I'll play by these rules. It makes me less productive, but I'll live with it.
That's a bummer.
Got to do what you got to do.
Exactly.
Hey,
man.
Once you get Sigwin on there, you know, it's close enough to a Unix environment. If you've got it set up right, you can almost not even tell. Just slightly slower. So, you know, I've got it tweaked. Actually, my XFCE setup, I run two SecureX sessions, one to my Sigwin and one to a SUSE box on my desk. And they're in two separate windows, one on each monitor at work, and you cannot tell them apart. I've got them configured identically. The only way you know is when you change to the root directory and you do some listing, you see some weirdness under Sigwin. When you show your mount command, it shows like all these weird mounted drives. So that's when you find out you're not in Kansas anymore.
Yeah, it's when the party crashes.
Yeah, it's when you just go, oh, well, that's ugly. I won't look there.
I'm gonna have
so
to
anyways, I don't know if I'm boring you with this crazy stuff.
No, not at all. That's what we're the tech show. We live for the
Sigwin.com, CYGWIN.com. What I typically, since hard drive space is cheap and because I use so many of the utilities, I typically just go there and install everything. pretty lame of me, but you know, it's like I've got it all.
See,
I've got if I wanted everything.
You know, all of this talk makes me almost want to go out and try that, but the problem is that I don't run Windows on anything, so...
Well, there you go.
Somebody else will have to tell me how it is, you know?
I could start downloading it for you right now, and then we'll kill our bandwidth.
Yeah. Bandwidth will drop down the toilet.
It's been so long. Do they have a... How's the install for that? Is that like a network install?
You can make it that way. You can say, hey, take the files and put them on a local drive somewhere, and which can be very useful, and then everyone on the network can just pull them from there. It's really, really well done, their installation program. I don't know if you realize the Sigwin, where it comes from, but essentially it's part of, it was done by the Cygnus people. That's where I think the CYG comes from. I think it's where some of the first people to actually make money off of free software, or if possibly the first, by making the GCC compiler or support for GCC is where they made their money.
Yeah. Man. I gotta try that out. They have KDE for Sigwin?
Yes, they do.
Holy moly. Windows.
Yeah, how sad is
that? And XFCE and Window Maker's there.
All right. Window Maker.
Yeah.
Man. And,
you know, there's just about everything you start digging around, you'll find. I don't think they've got GNOME ported yet, but I think.
They want to know on the IRC if Sigwin can access NFS shares.
Oh, gosh. That would be interesting, but I don't know if it does. I don't use NFS. If I can help it, I don't use it.
That'd be your paradise link. KDE on top of Sigwin on top of Windows XP.
You think?
Home edition.
I don't think so. Only if I, you know, maybe if I tried running all that in a virtual computing environment on my Linux box or something.
There you
know?
Go. Like underneath VMware?
Yep.
That would be you'd probably be able to retire before, like, the KDE session starts.
Yeah, your council session will come up tomorrow.
It's just kind of nice to be able to have the actual stuff there. I really am hoping someday Microsoft will get a clue about POSIX programming and actually put it in their OS. I don't think that's going to happen, fortunately. I think that it's going to just help push more and more people towards using Linux, and that's not a bad thing for me, as far as I'm concerned. It just means, you know, more of what I like.
You know what? I'll tell you, though. When I go to a Windows machine, and I'm like, damn, I need to get a piece of software that I have on one of my Linux boxes, it is such a hassle. Because there's no, you know, SCP. There's, you know...
You got to use like PuTTY. Got to download PuTTY real quick.
You right. Know? If you don't have PuTTY, you got to, you know, you just like, well, what do you have?
You don't need PuTTY with Cygwin.
No, you don't.
You can actually use Bash Native, and you can have secure copy, and it works. It's the actual open SSH. You know, it's ported.
Yeah, but Cygwin's not installed by default on Windows like it should be now.
It should be. Just get your, if you're in a big enough environment, just get your desktop people and make sure it's one of the installed packages.
Yeah, and that's just it's so crippling. I mean, you sit down at an OS X machine, you SCP on a Linux, FreeBFD, whatever. You know, you sit down at a Windows machine and you're like, well, if I can't get to it through the Internet Explorer,
right,
I can't really do anything.
Internet Exploder.
You got to put Apache on wherever it is, and then you pull it through HTTP.
Oh, yeah.
But no.
Oh, man.
That's a little overkill, but... No, you're right. Yep. I've done that.
I've done it, too, so...
Desperate measures, but I've been there before, where the only port I had through the particular firewall was 80 and needed the data, and that's how it got transferred.
Oh. You can't even shell into another machine with Windows, unless you're doing Telnet, if you don't have PuTTY.
Don't want to run Windows Telnet.
Oh,
they actually have a Unix toolkit that's now getting very long in the tooth, Microsoft does. I believe it's the MKS toolkit that they bought it from somebody.
Wait, yeah, that's...
It's junk. I installed it. This is probably like a year ago. I haven't done it recently, so I should be real careful. But when I did, it actually turned on like a whole bunch of insecure services, like Finger, stuff that we learned to turn off in the Linux community, like say 5 years ago. You know, that just stuff all got turned on, and I like looked at it, and my hair curled. It's not normally curly, and I went and uninstalled it as quickly as I could because I could see the environment where I was, they scanned it all the time for vulnerabilities, and I had just added a whole bunch of really old, insecure Unix vulnerabilities to my computer.
You're like, what? Who's this idiot that we hired?
Well, it would have been horrible. I mean, it was stuff like CharGen and Finger and like that stuff. That
you can just see the IP cops running up to somebody and saying, "How the hell did you get Finger on running on a Windows computer?" You know.
Oh, I got a really funny story that's inverted from that. I was working in another enterprise class environment. This would have been probably about 4 years ago, and I had a Linux box, and I firewalled my Windows box off behind it. Okay, which really pissed off the network PC Nazis. But even funnier still is I had Samba on the Linux box so that I could mount stuff, you know, here and there.
Mm-hmm.
And I made the server identification string for Samba say that it was some really advanced version of Windows that wasn't even in beta testing yet. Like, this is like 2001. I was like 2003 advanced server or something. I made some folks came up. And they totally freaked out. They came like, what are you running, you know? Because it identified as that. It was hilarious. Oh, God. And then shortly after that, I was laid off. Anyways. Was laughing the whole way. Never been so happy to be let go of my entire life. No, I'm just kidding. Actually, I'm not kidding that much. So, anyways, yeah, that's not. I'm not making that up. That happened to me.
Wow.
Yeah, it's funny shit right there.
What wasn't Microsoft? Didn't they buy those Unix tools? as part of their step for...
They actually,
Yep.
That was was part of their process for migrating Unix users.
Right, and they did that a couple years ago. You remember they were pimping the CDs out at the Linux World Expo a few years back? Like, you couldn't even walk around the corner next to them before someone was stuffing one of them Unix Toolkit CDs in your back pocket.
Yep. Yeah, I think that's how I got mine. Is somebody was at a trade show and they came back with it. They're like, you have to try this.
Come back with one. Shit, man, I came back with like 15 copies of that thing. You couldn't walk anywhere near them.
I was like, why would I use this instead of Cygwin? I just took it completely off. And actually, I think I had to reinstall Cygwin for some stupid reason. And I was pretty disappointed. I was like, there's nothing in here that isn't in Cygwin. And there are things in Cygwin that are not in this thing. Like, there was no secure shell stuff at that time. There might be now, but it wasn't then. And I just think that they're really doing themselves a disservice by not putting that particular, especially secure shell, in the product they have.
Wonder, can you use Cygwin to share Windows Server shares and not pay a license for those shares?
I don't know that Samba is ported to Cygwin, but you would think that would be a possibility.
There you go. That's how you beat the system.
Right.
Yeah.
Because of the what is it, client access license that they want for everything.
That's true. Now, couldn't you, and I've done this in a Novell environment where I have taken a Windows share and connected it under Linux as a Samba connection and then shared it out.
Theoretically, you're only using one connection, I know.
Yeah, and I've shared it out.
Eula, I think, is written to take advantage of this situation and say, no, you got this many users having access to the data.
Yeah.
I could be wrong.
Well, who's good to know? As long as you're not running finger on it.
Right, exactly. I would like to give them the finger on this particular one because it doesn't make any sense, but that's how it works. Their licensing is really harebrained like that. So, but the whole idea to me has always kind of seemed a bit odd.
What are you gonna do? What was it? You gotta for their.
You do
terminal
what I do when you just
client,
set up a
man.
Linux box in the corner and then hijack that share, and then shut the Microsoft server off, and no one will even know. That's how you do it.
They'll know because you didn't need to reboot the server every week.
Yeah, right.
It's running fast.
That's the only way they tell. Didn't you do something funny in there with that server? Because it's been running really great for the last month and a half. Yeah.
I've used Samba a long, long time. About 96 is when I discovered it, if I remember right. And I used to install it on HPUX.
Hockey Pucks.
Yes, and we just charged them the installation time. Like, I was, you know, roving consultant kind of guy. So we couldn't charge them for the software, but we charged them for the installation time and the consulting for doing whatever it was they wanted done. And it's surprisingly versatile, the crazy stuff you can do with Samba. Terrific product.
Yeah, it's you know what? I think I remember what it was. I connected to an Apple share with Netatalk and shared it out through Samba.
Cool.
So I can connect it through the Novell login scripts. That was it. Now it's all coming back to me.
Well, let me tell you what won't work. Ready?
All right.
NFS mount something, share it out. No, that actually works somewhat. Use SMB client, not, no, pardon me, SMB mount. To mount a Windows share underneath your Samba server, and then turn around and re-export it with Samba, so that you can like take a whole bunch of network drives and consolidate them into one, you know, hierarchy.
Right.
It appeared to work until I tried to write to it, and then it kind of got a little slow.
How do you even come up with that kind of stuff? Like, now, well, what if I made
what
just
I
one
do,
giant
so we had a,
drive? out of everything that we have on our entire network. Wouldn't that be cool?
It was a bit broad what I was trying to do. it was an experiment. But the idea was we had a 4-gig tape backup drive where I was at, and we had like 5 Windows PCs that the salespeople used. This is we were doing Unix consulting type work, but the salespeople had all Windows PCs. And so I exported the drives, the shares on the Windows boxes, and tried to back them up, you know, from location, which actually didn't work too badly, but it was a mess. It didn't really do like what I wanted it to do, and it just killed the network. But then I thought, well, I had them all there, you know. Let's just export them with Samba. I can make one there. No.
That's
There's your answer.
That was worth a shot, though, huh?
But it was comic relief, you know. You
seemed like a fun thing to try at the time, I bet.
Now, if only you would have run that on SegWit.
Yeah,
maybe if I'd had more beer, you know. Could have made it work. But no, didn't have. I ran out of beer, you know.
Yep.
Yeah, we ran out of beer here too now.
Yeah, we're out of beer, and it's like 9:45. So
yeah, we got to start closing up because we gotta get home before the snow hits.
That's tomorrow night.
Well, it might take Link along. You're driving everybody home.
No way, man! I want to get out of here before Dan starts taking his clothes off to go to bed. That'll scare the hell out of me.
Paul, I want to thank you for coming on.
thank you.
The batch logging program looks very fascinating, and it's great that you put the effort into doing that, and the company allowed you to release it.
Thank you.
Are you working on any other projects that we should be aware of?
If you haven't been to LXER.com,
uh-huh.
That is the most kick-butt news site for Linux that you will ever see.
We like Elixir. They always post our postings on there.
You like it or don't like it?
We like it.
No,
we like
great.
It. Yeah, they talk about our show, so they're all right in our book, man.
It's an incredible site, and Dave Weitinger needs to be given as many kudos as possible. Dave Weitinger was a guy that started LinuxToday.com along with Dwight Johnson back in like 1997 or 98. It was slowly changed to a more corporate focus over the years. Still a decent website, but LXDR has become the community news site that Linux Today could have been. And I'm very happy to be a part of it. Haven't been lately because I've been kind of busy with some work issues, but I've been very happy to see it's growing and readership is up, and it's just an incredible site. It's what a community news site about Linux should be, and if you haven't been there and contributed or read or posted, you're really losing out on what community can be. It's just beautiful. So there's my plug.
There we go. LXR. That's LXR. I remember when that first started. What was that? Was that like a year and a half, 2 years ago? Yeah, it was a couple years. Yeah. Wasn't that long ago that I remember that.
Yeah.
Yeah, he bounced it out, and it's just been growing. And lately, it's really been growing. So I think we really got some momentum, and Tom Adelstein's doing a great job being the lead editor. He's just really, really done a lot of cool stuff. So go there, check the news daily, and comment, and become part of the community, because that's what this is really all about.
That's right. Just like he said.
All right, Paul, I want to thank you very much.
Thank you for having me on.
Yeah, I hope we could touch base with you again in the near future.
Yeah, it's great having you on.
Anytime.
All sure. Right, man.
All right.
Good luck. Have a happy holidays.
You too, guys.
Take
Merry Christmas.
Easy.
Good night.
Good night.
Good night. Bye-bye.
Bye.
All right, everybody, and there you go. That was a good interview.
I got to take a leak so bad.
That's a good interview. My ass hurts, man. Dan, I come over
Alan,
here,
move your hand at least.
Dan
give
makes
a little
me
massage.
Sit on these freaking chairs.
Massage the grapes.
And, like, you know, when you're an IT guy, you know, after a while, you tend to lose your ass, you know?
Yes.
And when all you have is, like, the two hip bones of your ass that stick out, over a stretch piece of skin, and you sit on a freaking wooden chair for an hour.
You could have had the
your
padded
ass
chair.
Hurts.
You have to start bringing pillows over here.
I'm telling you.
You know you're old when you freaking got to get a cushion.
Yeah, right, when you got to get a cushion. Oh, that's nasty. God. Dan, how can you smell the microphone after you do that? Man, that's that's gross.
Right down back in the middle school, everybody.
At least, well, listen, on that note, and what a note it was, we want to make mention of a thank you to Gomer X, one of our listeners who has generously decided to contribute some of his own bandwidth to the Linux Link Tech Show and host a mirror site. So,
thank you, Gomer.
Thank you, Gomer.
Thank you.
Much coolness goes to you. And by all means, folks, you know, if you're
thanks for extra time, too.
If you're hitting the site and stuff and we're a little bit slow, go right over to Gomer's site. It's listed on our downloads page as a mirror.
Speaking of mirrors, are we going to do a BitTorrent for high-quality AUG and MP3? Is that going to be a regular thing going forward?
I don't know. Are we?
What do you think? Dan?
If we do, I have to start playing with the balance controls to like move us all around the room. Screw with everybody's head in stereo.
Just trying to get with getting any kind of decent recording. I haven't. How are we going to do a high quality?
Well, the way
you have to record it at a higher bit rate. You know,
well, it's recording
for your AUG or something. What are you recording at now?
Project rate is 44/100. 32-bit float. You're talking about going above 32-bit?
Yeah.
To what? It's
no, I'm talking about... I'm talking about...
When we encode it.
Recording it at like 128K or something like that instead of whatever the hell we're recording at now.
Four-channel sound.
Yeah.
Quadraphonic.
We'll see about doing that next week, I guess. Because this is going at 32-bit.
Yeah. Well, we'll play with something, and you know, we'll probably do another BitTorrent test this week on the files, and just zip them all together again. Like
I'll leave my machine up. I'm down for that.
You can check it all out, but of course, you know, don't be looking for that until later on tomorrow afternoon
because
I ain't gonna have time to do it tonight.
Yes,
because Dan isn't done uploading all that crap until way after I'm already in bed. So, and then I have to work tomorrow. So piss on you. Now, check the stuff out tomorrow. Tomorrow afternoon, look for BitTorrent for episode 114, which is what we're on right now, right?
Yep.
And check that out. We'll do some more testing with that, and then we'll figure out where we're going to go from there. Do us a favor. Drop us an email if you're interested in higher quality audio feeds done through BitTorrent so we can figure out amongst ourselves.
Quadraphonic
exactly,
sound.
Yeah.
I'm interested.
Figure out amongst ourselves exactly what we're going to do.
Tech show, quadraphonic.
Dun, 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 dun. Hey, I think it's a good idea, though, because like, everybody else does that. So
we should do it.
There is, I don't know if you listen to BinRev 125, show 125 yet.
Not yet.
They had, I believe it was Lance James who wrote a book, Phishing Exposed. Really great show. That was not this week's, but last week's. Really great show. I recommend listening to it. And just from listening to the guy talking about it, it's like, wow, I really want to read that book, Phishing Exposed. You can get it at Amazon.com or I guess other places, too. Very fascinating. This week, BinRev, again, they've been live these past couple of shows. I think they're moving towards a live format. Droops was on there. And I know they were talking about.
Thanks to them for extending our time, too.
Yes, thank you, BinRev.
That was mightily cool of them, as a matter of fact.
So are we officially a two-hour show now?
No.
That means they've extended our time, and we will now move on to the 10:30 to 11:30 time slot for the next year. They're like, it could be 10:30 and be like, they got to cut off a bit of rev, and they'll come back. Pretty soon we're going to have from 8 o'clock till 2 o'clock in the morning.
we'll go to 3 hours when we get paid.
I'll tell you what, they have to pay me something. If they pay me some money, then I can get a comfortable chair.
Play us out, Dan.
Yeah, play us out.
How about some shout-outs, man? You want to do a couple
shout-outs? You know what? Yo.
Don't do that, Dan.
how about some fun?
Yo, MTV Raps.
White boy.
Don't do that, Dan.
Hey, when did I add that other skin to the forum? Was that this past week?
It's very blue.
That was tough, man.
What do you mean that was tough? You didn't like that?
The blue one was very
gave me a headache.
Blue.
I like that new blue form. I was like, well, what do I
thought that's pretty cool, that cobalt one or whatever it is.
Yeah. I'll add another one, and then
I like it.
I'll eventually get around to creating one. Ah, we got a on the forum from Eric. Said we should be trying one beer, one different beer each week. You'd like to hear that? And
I'm standing up, the ass hurts. Rub it for me, Alan.
What did he say? There was something I wanted to make a comment about what he said. Oh, just he had brought right up there, that yeah. He's listening to the show on the Creative Zen Extra, 60 gigabyte version. And he says when he fast forwards too far into the show, the Zen fails to continue forward and jumps to the next file or the next audio file that he has in there. So the fast forward of 1 minute is actually a fast forward of 2 minutes in the show. And fast forwarding past 30 minutes on the counter, 60 minutes into the show, bugs the Zen Extra and it moves to the next file. Which is interesting because that was a similar problem I was having with the Lug Radio MP3s on the iRiver, where it would get past like 30 minutes into the show, and after that the timer wouldn't work anymore. And if I paused it or stopped it, it wouldn't pick up. At that point, it would actually dump me into the next show.
That's a sucky thing.
So, I don't know.
How about some
good night, all.
How about some Frapper shout-outs to take us out?
Start shouting.
We got Chris Garland in Lindsay, Ontario, Canada.
Let's start playing the music.
Picks.
Too.
We got
Picks.
Philip
Picks.
In Kissimmee,
Picks,
Florida.
Picks.
Tom Lanema from Lombard, Picks. Illinois. Picks. Tom Kappen from Lodi, California.
Good night, all.
Dan from Miami. Ram Sinks from Meriden, Idaho.
Good night, John Boy.
Egman Matin Turan from Ankara, Turkey. Juan Lopez from Mexico City. Michael from Billings, Montana. Sean S. from Fort Smith, Arkansas. Mike Oliveri from Garden, Illinois. Isn't it cool to hear your name being called out? Anyways.
Patrick Davila from Easton, Pennsylvania.
Come on down.
Daniel Washko from Bethlehem, Pennsylvania. Lincoln Fessenden from Easton, Pennsylvania. Alan Metzler from Planet Zane.
Alexandro Colorado from Villa Hermosa, Tabasco, Mexico. Albert Meijer from Berwick, Noord-Holland, the Netherlands. Parallax from Santa Cruz de Tenerife.
How many people are on that Frapper map now?
280.
That's pretty good, but that's like 30, more 40 than more week. Than last week, yeah.
All right.
All righty, people.
Look, ready for me to play?
Next week, we're going to have Joe Bourne from Neuros Audio. See you then.
I guess I better play this audio.
Something, something.
Oh, yo, yo, yo.
Yo, yo.
Don't go chasing.
Hey, good night, everybody. If you don't hear from us, if you don't listen to our show next week, just want to make sure we wish y'all a Merry Christmas.
What's that?
We'll be
what,
here.
Alan?
Don't go chasing my heart.
Don't go chasing my heart. I don't know how that goes. I don't know the lyrics to that song.
Damn it. Now I'm going to have that rolling in my head for the next, 6 hours tonight.
Ready?
Just run.
I've never prayed to you before. I have no tongue for it. No one. Not even you will remember if we were good men or bad. Why we fought or why we died. No. All that matters is that two stood against many. That's what's important. Valor pleases you, Crom. So grant me one request. Grant me revenge.
And if you do not listen...
The hell with you!
While you were making Egg Foo Young in the kitchen, I was in the dining room having sushi.
Shut up.
Just shut up. It's over.
Shut up, shutting up.